Meaningful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Faith based on understanding. Saturday, the 4th of Ramadan, 1394, 21st of September, 1974. The prophets are all drivers of a single caravan, guiding the caravan on a single path. Leading it to a single destination, with people from all places all going together towards a single terminus. The faithful say, we make no distinction between any of his apostles. The Quran, Surah 2, verse 285. We respect Isa, Musa, Ibrahim, and Idris just as much as Ya'qub. We respect Jesus, Moses, Abraham, and Idris just as much as Jacob and George, just as much as Noah. We respect all of the prophets, from the first to the last. All of them were acting by God's command. All of them were directed by Him to the same destination. All of them gave glad tidings of the same felicity and the same paradise. All of them followed the same line. We make no distinction between any of His apostles. As for why we believe in the prophethood of this line of prophets, we will, inshallah, discuss this in turn on another occasion. And they say, this is a part of Surah number 2, verse 285. Pay attention to these two or three sentences as they illustrate something that we will return to later.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
So the prophets have faith. Our prophet has it. The believers and those that follow him also all have faith. And they say, we hear and obey. In other words, they hear, they understand, and they obey. Hearing here does not simply signify sounds reaching their ears. Hearing is more than this. Hearing is more than this. Because the act of hearing involves more than just one's ear. You might tell someone to lend an ear when you are speaking to them. But at the end, what do you ask them? You ask, did you hear what I said? Now, obviously, when you are talking to someone, there is no more than half a meter separating you. Your normal speaking voice can carry for 10 meters or more. So, of course, he heard what you said, but what you really mean is, did he understand it? Of course, it went into his ear, but what you want to know is, did it go into his mind? So, when those with faith say, we hear, this means we understand with the totality of our being. What Allah sent down to us and what He specified for us. And obey. What does this mean then? It does not mean blind obedience. It means that they obey based on knowledge and understanding of what they have heard.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all.
the wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
China seems to be going through a decisive change towards a one-man ruling system after several decades of power shifting. President Xi also has total control over the Politburo that he introduced among his closest allies. His power even extends to the military, as he also holds the title of Chairman of the Central Military Commission. In his most recent address to the CCP, President Xi pledged to pursue a very communist idea. He pledged to redistribute wealth to reduce inequality, as well as full employment. He also added promotion of gender equality, expansion of social security and healthcare, protecting the environment, and fighting the cancer of corruption as other items on his agenda. Despite the controversies that mainstream media tried to bring Xi into, China's current and future leader has been able to put the nation on a fast track to dethroning the U.S. as the world's number one superpower. But the U.S. isn't the only country that isn't enjoying the shift of power from west to the east. Josep Borrell, the representative of the European Union, whose recent mildly racist slash elitist comments stirred emotions.
Yes, Europe is a garden. We have built a garden. Everything. The rest of the world, and you know very well, Federica, is not exactly a garden. The rest of the world, most of the rest of the world, is a jungle. And the jungle could invade the garden. And the gardeners should take care of it.
Has admitted to the role that China and Russia have played in his garden's prosperity. He said, "I think that the Chinese workers with their low salaries have done much better and much more to contain inflation than all the central banks together." He also said, "Our prosperity was based on China and Russia, energy and market. Clearly today, we have to find new ways for energy from inside the European Union, as much as we can, because we should not change one dependency for another." This is not the first time that Ursula von der Leyen makes inflammatory or accusatory comments about China or Russia. She does still recognize the crucial role that China plays in European economy, though. In the follow-up of the EU-China summit that took place in late June, she said that the EU-China relationship is simultaneously, quote, "one of the most strategically important and one of the most challenging." Regardless of what the EU or the US or the mainstream media says about Xi Jinping, or the numerous criticisms they throw his way, China is not fazed or threatened. China's economic recovery from numerous challenges, including COVID, came much earlier than many big global economies. And so the best market for China's goods has now become China itself. As Borrell said, the EU is reliant on Chinese goods and services, and not the other way around. This is the reason why the EU, despite warning China not to trade with Russia amid EU sanctions, hasn't been able to take any decisive action against the Asian superpower. The US has also tried to undermine China through meddling in Taiwan's affairs. In fact, US President Joe Biden has made his most explicit statement so far on the issue by outright stating that US forces would defend Taiwan in case of a Chinese attack. He was even asked to clarify if he meant whether American men and women, unlike in Ukraine, would defend the island, to which he replied, "Yes." Despite all the attempts made by US or the EU to undermine China, as Borrell stated, the EU can certainly look for domesticizing production and decreasing its reliance on China, but as it stands, the idea seems more like a distant dream than anything resembling an actual short-term applicable plan to get Europe out of the crisis it's in.
The Palestinian movement Hamas has restored relations with the Syrian government after holding a historic meeting with the Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. The Syrian president also met with Palestinian factions. This is the first such visit by Hamas officials to the Syrian capital since the year 2012. Hamas said the movement will continue to build and develop solid relations with the Syrian Arab Republic, considering that this decision serves the nation and its just causes, with the cause of Palestine at its core. Yet the important question is, why the resumption of ties at this time? For starters, the resumption of relations between Hamas and Damascus would strengthen the axis of resistance in West Asia. Hamas will now cement its role within the axis of resistance against its enemy, Israel. This may impact the way each acts against the other, especially militarily. This reconciliation appears to have rattled the U.S. cage, which was quick to denounce the move. It said the Assad regime's outreach to this terrorist organization only reinforces its isolation. It also harms the interests of the Palestinian people. But Hamas's move formalizes a rapprochement that has been underway for some time and comes amid fundamental shifts in West Asia. For example, Turkey is considering a rapprochement with Assad. The UAE has already done the same. Also, Jordan's King Abdullah II has showed overtures. The United Arab Emirates and Bahrain have gone ahead and reopened their embassies in Damascus. This is while senior officials in several Arab states are pressing to reinstate Syria's membership of the Arab League. Another important development has taken place that cannot go unnoticed. Palestinian factions signed a reconciliation agreement in Algeria, in which Hamas, Fatah, and 12 other Palestinian groups agreed to hold legislative and presidential elections within 1 year. In the Algiers meeting, Ismail Haniyeh said, "This is a historical moment through which we see Al-Quds." He thanked the Algerian president, Abdelmadjid Tebboune, for his country's efforts in sponsoring the talks. But what did he mean exactly? How would this reconciliation enable Palestinians to see Al-Quds? Yet the timing of these two events, the Algiers reconciliation of Palestinian factions, then Hamas's trip to Syria, gives the impression that there are serious diplomatic moves being made between Palestinian factions. Another development, which is another piece to this puzzle, is the head of Hamas's political bureau chief, Ismail Haniyeh, visiting Moscow recently and holding high-level political talks with Russian officials, including the foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov. This puts the spotlight on Russia's role here. Russia is signaling how it wants to play a more constructive role when it comes to the West Asia region, especially when it comes to Palestinians. This couldn't be any clearer than the stance that the PA President Mahmoud Abbas took when it came to Russia, which was relayed during the SICA meeting that was held recently. The Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas, who met with the Russian President Vladimir Putin, relayed to him his mistrust of the U.S. in resolving the conflict with Israel, expressing an appreciation for Russia's role. He voiced his support for the Mideast quartet of international mediators, namely Russia, the U.S., the United Nations, and the European Union, but said the U.S. could not be left a free hand to act alone. He said, "We don't trust America, and you know our position. We don't trust it, we don't rely on it, and under no circumstances can we accept that America is the sole party in resolving a problem." Maybe that is why the U.S. is raising the alarm over the reconciliation between Fatah and Hamas. Now that they are on one page, they can act with one voice against Israel and the U.S. And the U.S. reaction to this is very telling when it says that it will take this out against Palestinians instead of taking a diplomatic approach towards the two groups reconciling, since they can speak with one voice for the Palestinians. This may mean that there would be more pressure and violations by Israel against the Palestinians with full U.S. support.
The Twitter account of UN Human Rights Council addressed the report published by the three-member commission and shared the link to it. The title of the report very clearly addresses the occupation to be unlawful under international law with zero ambiguity. The report states the reason for the conclusion to be the permanence of the occupation as well as Israel's de facto annexation policies. Navi Pillai, chair of the commission, stated, "Recent statements by the Secretary General and numerous member states have clearly indicated that any attempt at unilateral annexation of a state's territory by another is a violation of international law and is null and void. 143 member states, including Israel, last week voted in favor of a General Assembly resolution reaffirming this." The chair also further added, "Unless universally applied, including to the situation in the occupied Palestinian territory, this core principle of the United Nations Charter will become meaningless." The 28-page report published by Navanethem Pillai, Milun Kothari, and Christopher Sidoti highlights the sustenance and the advancement of the settlement enterprise, and the continuous expansion over the past couple of years that resulted in many Palestinian families to be forced out of their homes only for foreigners who've never been to the land to occupy their homes.
Yaakov, you know this is not your house.
Yes, but if I go, you don't go back. So what's the problem? What are you yelling at me? I didn't do this.
But it's
easy to yell at me, but I didn't do this.
You are stealing my house.
And if I don't steal it, someone else is going
to
steal it.
No one is allowed to steal it, Yammi.
Statements by Israeli officials that showed their intention to maintain permanent control over the expanding settlements were also noted in the reports and were part of the reason why the occupation was declared unlawful. Chair of the commission also recognized the direct and indirect transferring of Israelis into the settlements as a plan to ensure permanent Israeli control in the West Bank. The Independent International Commission of Inquiry on the Occupied Palestinian Territory, including Al-Quds and in Israel. That is the name that the UN gave to the commission in May of 2021 when the UN Human Rights Council held a special session on the grave human rights situation in the Occupied Palestinian Territory. During the session, the UNHRC decided to establish an urgent international commission of inquiry to investigate alleged human rights violations in the occupied Palestinian territories at the hands of Israel. The recent report is the culmination of what the three-member council has found during the past year and a half in what seems to be an uncharacteristically direct accusation of Israeli human rights violation and breaking of international law. Let's take a quick look at some of the bullet points mentioned in the report. An allusion to the core principles of the UN on annexation, which Israel seems to have also agreed to, even though it has violated it. The existence of a settlement enterprise and the efforts to make settlement permanent, violating the rights of Palestinians who were forced to leave as settlers took their homes by force. Israelis' exploitation of land and natural resources, the restrictive urban planning and zoning policies that seize Palestinian construction as an impediment to settlements that result in frequent confiscation of land, demolition of homes, and eventually displacement. The silent harm and psychological trauma resulting from erosion of economic, social, and cultural rights of Palestinians in a coercive environment that fragments the Palestinian society. The necessity of international action as Israeli government's actions are seen by the commission as criminal, particularly its direct and indirect transfer of civilian population into occupied and annexed territories. The report seems to be a step in the right direction for the UN to fulfill its sole responsibility of standing up for human rights violations globally. But whether or not the criminal accusations towards Israel will lead to an International Court of Justice investigation and trial remains to be seen, especially when Israel has the unwavering support of the U.S.
Iran has doubled down on its earlier stance that it has not supplied weapons to Russia to be used against Ukraine. Foreign Ministry officials say those claims are untrue and based on false information. Tehran says the accusations are part of a propaganda campaign by the West to stoke tensions with Iran. The accusations against Iran have been leveled by Ukraine and its Western backers. They say Russia has been using Iranian-made drones to strike Ukrainian cities in recent weeks. The Kremlin has also roundly denied the accusation, saying it's using Russia-made weapons in its strikes. Also, some Western media outlets have cited U.S. security officials as saying that more Iranian drones as well as missiles are to be shipped to Russia. But the Pentagon says it cannot confirm those reports. However, it says it will take steps to make the sale of Iranian drones harder. Ukraine has also threatened to cut diplomatic ties with Iran. But Tehran says it holds a neutral stance and believes dialogue is the best way to end the war. Iran has invariably stressed the need for respect for various countries' sovereignty, independence, and territorial integrity, including Ukraine, based on the principles of the United Nations Charter.
The Islamic Republic of Iran has taken a clear and consistent position on the situation in Ukraine, which has been pronounced since the start of the conflict. The Islamic Republic of Iran has always emphasized that all UN members must fully respect the purpose and principles enshrined in the United Nations Charter as well as applicable international law.
The accusations against Iran come amid intensifying tensions at war fronts in Ukraine. Citizens and pro-Russian officials are evacuating from the main city in Kherson region just as Ukrainian forces are pushing to take back the area from Russia. Over 60,000 people will be evacuated within the next 6 days. The anti-Iran claims first emerged in July. Back then, U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan alleged that Washington had received, quote, information indicating that Iran was preparing to provide Russia with up to several hundred unmanned aerial vehicles, including weapons-capable UAVs, on an expedited timeline. Flying at low altitude, these unmanned aircraft can evade traditional air defense systems before dive bombing their targets. The distinctive delta wing design of the drones has led Ukrainian and Western officials to claim that they are Iranian Shahed 136 UAVs. Russia's use of the so-called kamikaze drones has sparked panic in Ukraine. The United States, Britain and France were planning to raise the claim during a closed-door UN Security Council meeting. They accuse Iran of violating a UN Security Council resolution that had placed an arms embargo on Iran. The arms embargo expired in 2020, despite the efforts of former US President Donald Trump to renew it.
Iran categorically rejected unfounded and unsubstantiated claims that Iran has transferred UAVs for the use of the conflict in Ukraine. It is recently disappointing that to pursue their political agenda, these states are trying to launch a disinformation campaign against Iran.
So, dear colleagues, today we have observed another round of the disinformation campaign from the Security Council by the Western delegations, as they raised in the Council the issue of the UAVs allegedly used by Russia in Ukraine. The aim of our Western colleagues is clear. They attempt to hit two targets at once, inventing an artificial pretext to put pressure on Russia and on Iran.
The accusations come amid continued NATO military support for Ukraine. The West is now under fire for fanning the flames of war by sending more and more military hardware there. It's now believed that the accusations made against Iran are part of a larger media campaign against the Islamic Republic. the West, led by the United States, were trying to pressurize Iran by supporting the rioters in Iran during the recent tensions. They imposed a series of sanctions on Iranian officials over human rights allegations. However, they failed to dictate their will on Iran.
IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
I would like to take this opportunity to talk about one dimension of the personality of Amir al-Mu'mineen.
السلام عليك يا أمين الله في أرض.
Peace be upon you, O trusted guardian, appointed by Allah.
The universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother.
Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time. And in today's world, overcome by evil and darkness, and oppression and slavery, and tyranny and falsehood, a quick look into this beacon of truth and justice, a look into the universal persona of Imam Ali, is greatly useful for making and changing our lives, our families, our societies, and our world into the beautiful world that Allah has planned for humanity.
What non-Muslims say about Ali, the first successor of Prophet Muhammad.
Gerald Dogari, 1897 to 1984, a distinguished soldier and diplomat, says the following about Imam Ali in his book, Rulers of Mecca, page 49. He had been wise in counsel and brave in battle, true to his friends and magnanimous to his foes. He was to be forever the paragon of Muslim nobility and chivalry.
Ali Imam Manasto Manam Gulam Ali Ali Imam Manasto Manam Gulam Ali بدار جان گرامی فدائے نام علی بدار جان گرامی فدائے نام علی اے دنی.
Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the program's to my brother, and we're discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam. Dear friends, when we talk about the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam, of course, we find that this is a persona and an individual and a human being who has been able to transcend time and age. So, for example, we find that in all times of history up until the present day, where over 1,000 years have passed, the persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam is truly something that should be followed, that must be followed. And if we are to correctly follow the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam, of course, we will find that the world will become a much better and more beautiful place to live in. It is the different qualities of Imam Ali alayhi salam we find that are necessary in the present day and age, whether it is social justice, whether it is economic and financial justice, whether it is the taking care of the oppressed and the poor and the downtrodden and the needy, or whether it is to keep in check the different arrogant powers and individuals who take advantage of the oppressed and the weak, or whether it is to keep in check those who amass the wealth to an extent where they can never even use that amount of wealth. All these kind of different points and these kind of different aspects of the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam that are very applicable in today's age and time. And so we wonder is, well, why should we consider the persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam to be so important and so integral? Well, this is where the traditions of the Messenger of Allah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam come into play as regards to how the Holy Prophet described Imam Ali and how the Holy Prophet showed the people the different characters, qualities, and moral virtues and status of Imam Ali alayhi salam. And so on the day of Khaybar, we find that the Messenger of Allah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam says, "I will give the banner of Islam to a man who loves Allah and His Messenger, and Allah and His Messenger love him as well. He is a champion who has never turned his back on war, and he kills the ill-fated enemies of Islam with his sword." And so this, dear friends, is just one of the traditions and one of the historical instances that shows us and proves to us the status of Imam Ali alayhi salam and why his universal persona should be followed. For example, the first thing, Imam Ali loved Allah and His Messenger, and likewise Allah and His Messenger loved him as well. We do not find that the Messenger of Allah has said this about anybody else. And here he's saying that Allah loves him. That's a big thing to say. And that he is a champion who has never turned his back on war, and it is his sword that has killed the enemies of Islam. So we can easily say that if it weren't for the defense of Imam Ali, if it weren't for this persona that inculcated courage and bravery on the battlefield and off the battlefield, if it wasn't for his persona, we would not have something by the name of Islam in the present day. And so it is thanks to the universal persona of Imam Ali that we must follow in the present day if we want to save this world that is going to help us to succeed. And so another profound lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Oh.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, the program To My Brother. I'm Atta, the producer of this program, and at this moment, I invite you to listen to the Arabic text of Ziyara Aminullah along with the English translation. Please stay tuned.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم إن قلوب المخبتين إليك والها وسبل الراغبين إليك شارعا
O Allah, verily the hearts of those who surrender to Thee are full of passionate love. The path of those who long for Thee is the straight, true road. The instructions given by those who lead on Thee are distinct and precise. The minds of those who are aware of Thy reality are filled with awe and reverence. The call of those who invite unto Thee is loud and clear, and the doors of approval are kept open for them. Whoso submits his supplication to Thee receives a favorable answer. Whoso turns repentant unto Thee gets acceptance and amnesty. Whoso bursts into tears in fear of Thy punishment obtains mercy. Whoso seeks redress from Thee finds the required assistance at his disposal. Whoso asks for Thy help procures the aid as a gift. Thy promise made with Thy servants is fulfilled. Whoso asks for pardon of his errors finds them reduced to nothing. Whoso does everything for Thy sake discovers that each and every deed has been preserved. The means of livelihood available to the created being come from Thee, like a rainfall, and in addition, many recurring favors and bounties reach them in regular succession. The sin of those who ask for forgiveness are overlooked. The wants and needs of all that which has been created by Thee are properly satisfied. Those who put forward genuine demands get more than they ask for, one after the other, again and again. For the hungry, wholesome food is arranged. For the thirsty, clean water is available in abundance.
Now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Ja'far Ja'far.
So whenever we hear the fadail of Imam Ali alayhi salam, we must always put the Prophet as not included amongst the people being talked about. This is an automatic rule that we were taught when we were studying. They never include the Prophet in this. When the Imam Ali alayhi salam says, I'm the best at this, except for the Prophet, because he is a servant of the Prophet. So this is an important rule to understand. Now, we come back to the same thing, and I always, as one who prepares lectures, comes up, I face the same difficulties, and that is, how do we begin to describe this great personality or talk about him? And I want to look at it for his life from his power of attraction and his power of repulsion. Yeah? What do I mean by that? I mean that Imam Ali alayhi salam has that characteristic where he has the power to attract people towards him, and at the same time, he has the power to repel people away from him. Yes? That means he has this ability to make people love him and hate him at the same time. This is an art, my brothers and sisters. How you can be loved so much and how you can be hated so much. Imam Ali alayhi salam teaches us how to do this. And when we look at history, there is no other personality like Imam Ali alayhi salam who is loved as much and hated as much by people. Since the beginning, There were those who would give their lives for Ali ibn Abi Talib, but there were those who couldn't wait to kill Ali ibn Abi Talib. And that carries on till today. There are people like us that when the name of Ali is said, our hearts begin to beat faster. And there are people who the name of Ali is mentioned, they can't wait to curse Ali ibn Abi Talib. This is till today.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Midstream.
Dr. Buthaina, an honor to be at your presence, and thank you for being with us to discuss pressing issues in Syria.
Thank you very much, Marwa, for coming to Damascus. It's a pleasure having you.
Our honor. Dr. Buthaina, I want us to begin with the ever-complicated game of geopolitics that Syria has a great and big role in it ever since the dawn of history, but specifically in the past two decades. The Western and regional regimes are acting as if Syria is just post-war, and they're trying to find some sort of new ways to maneuver politically with Syria, especially with the on-stage now war between Russia and Ukraine being center stage at the moment. And the biggest issue that Syria is still facing with the four most challenging and pressing issues is the occupation of the U.S. Forces in the eastern part of the Euphrates. You have the occupation of the Turks in the north, occupation of the Israelis in the Golan area, in the Golan Heights, and their aggression, continuous aggression. And also, we have remnants of Daesh in certain areas, which are, by the way, in areas where the U.S. is still in Syria. But now, in what stage would you say Syria is right now, considering all these pressing challenges we just mentioned?
First, when the war started on Syria, there were only the Takfiri terrorists who are launching this war in all parts of Syria. Only when the Syrian Arab Army with its alliances with Hezbollah, with Russia, with Iran, were able to defeat these terrorists in most areas in Syria, those who were leading the war by proxy, exactly the parties you named, the U.S., Israel, Turkey, jumped into the ground and came in order to continue the mission of the terrorists whose mission was to destroy Syria, to destroy its identity, to destroy its institutions. And therefore, and as you mentioned also, it is paradoxical that Daesh, that the U.S. claims to be fighting, is there in the neighborhood, in the areas, in the domain where the U.S. Steals our oil and our wheat and the resources of the Syrian people. Therefore, we are at another stage, really, of fighting against occupation. So I see these four occupations you mentioned as another side of the coin of the terrorist war that was launched in Syria. And their mission is to continue trying to divide Syria, trying to subjugate the Syrian people, trying to strangle the Syrian people by stealing its resources, by enforcing these extremely horrible unilateral measures that are unknown in humanity, that are against all human and international law. But as the Syrian people defeated the terrorists, they are going to defeat all these occupations, and Syria will be back united. Syria is 10,000 years old. This city, Damascus, is the eldest continuously inhabited capital in the world. The question why? Because its people will always come out from the rubble and rebuild it. And the aggressors are always defeated. And those who occupy parts of our land will be defeated.
Well, it does not take two to realize that when something positive tries to happen in the region, you always have the United States of America trying and attempting to break that positive thing. Like, for example, breaking the isolation of Syria, it wouldn't allow it, especially which would put Syria back on the regional scene heavily. Maybe by ensuring its military presence, pressing that they're there to help certain groups. But there's a certain rapprochement that's being spoken about in the media between Syria and Turkey, which is one of the biggest players in the global war against Syria. And when we talk about a rapprochement, we need to talk about trust. Where do you think Syria is on the ladder of trust with Turkey at the moment?
Well, I would like to draw your attention, Marwa, to the fact that we have 830 kilometers borders with Turkey. And if we didn't have these borders, those mercenaries from all over the world would not have been able to come to Syria. What I mean is that Turkey was the gateway for all the terrorists from all over the world to come to Syria. And Turkey was a major player in this terrorist war that was launched on Syria. And of course, it ended up by occupying parts of our land when the terrorists could not do the job that it wanted them to do. Therefore, what we hear in the media, for us, it doesn't mean much really, because there is no real initiative on the ground. There is no real talk on the ground. I mean, countries do not start talking through media. If those who occupy our lands have to withdraw first, have to show goodwill that they don't have really the intent to occupy our land for a long period, and that they are ready to withdraw, and that they start withdrawing. At least they honor the agreements they made. Erdogan signed with President Putin. He didn't honor the agreement he signed to withdraw and to let the M4 be free from Latakia to Aleppo. He didn't honor any of the agreements he did. And therefore, they are bubbling in the media. And as you notice, Syria did not say anything because it doesn't mean much to us. It's not serious unless we see serious steps towards this. Trust you build with somebody who is trustworthy, whose history shows that he is trustworthy, but he has to prove on the ground with action, as the Americans say, actions speak louder than words. So all what we hear is words. We need to see actions.
Well, this brings us to discuss the relationship of Syria with its allies this time, and that stood in support of Syria's territorial integrity and Syria's sovereignty against all that had happened. And one of the main allies of Syria is the Russian Federation. It helped fight terrorism and Western neocolonialism, but it's always found in pan-Arab media after every aggression that Syria is faced from the Israeli entity. We see that the media focuses on Russia, our pan-Arab media focuses on Russia negatively. And they say this because they say that because of Russia removing the S-300, this is a permissive move for the Israelis to attack Damascus. Therefore, they hold similar responsibility. And I know that you might disagree with this, but how would you explain the sideline behavior of Syria's main ally at a time when Israel does not miss a chance to try and break Syria militarily and economically?
Well, let me first comment in your sentence, pan-Arab media. Unfortunately, most of this pan-Arab media does not represent Arab ambitions and Arab rights and does not even reflect the truth about the Arabs. The second part of it is that Russia, as an ally, took the first double veto with China against Western intended aggression towards Syria on 4th of October 2011. Since that time, Russia has taken 17 vetoes against intended Western aggression towards Syria, and China joined Russia in 10 of these vetoes. So this is an ally that you can't trust. Mm-hmm. And then in 2015, as you know, Russia came to the ground with advisors, with Air Force help to the Syrian army to help the Syrian army in fighting terrorism. But all this, if you want, media war against Russia in Syria is to strengthen the enemy, really, and to try and make the people feel that Russia is not trustworthy, that we should not trust Russia. Russia today is fighting a war on behalf of humanity, really, because the war in the Ukraine is, in its truth, is a war between a Western hegemony and between the world that aspires to have its own independent decision and its own integrity. And therefore, Russia, of course, has its own geopolitical needs. And as allies, we understand each other and we agree with each other on any steps. But they did not mention that Russia and the Russian air forces and the Syrian air forces are leading attacks against terrorists in the northeast and the northwest of Syria. They didn't mention the effort Russia is making in order to prevent U.S. allies from partitioning Syria. They don't mention the positive side. We, as Syria, have a trustworthy ally in Russia. Every step, every move is agreed by both, both of us, and there's no problem at all. And just imagine that Syria without allies in the region, or Russia without allies. We need to really solidify our alliance. And I was talking to you off air that the strength of the West is that they get their alliances together, even to do wars and to do wrong things. So we should do our alliances together and strengthen them to do good things, to keep our identity, to keep our independence, to keep our integrity. All the media that tries to plant doubts, either against Russia or against Iran. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are many in the Arab media now, they say the problem is not Israel, it's Iran.
Definitely, and this is where I want to end off with the allies of Syria here, because it's no secret that Iran and Hezbollah played a great role alongside the Syrian Arab Army in preventing the Takfiri terrorism from Syria and eliminating also from Iraq and Lebanon. But they're also being blamed in the Western mainstream media and Israeli media as well, as they being the reason that Israel is bringing out its weapons and bombing Syria. Have these allies become some sort of a burden for Syria because they are here to help, because that's why Israel is bombing?
No, not at all. The only burden in the region is the Zionist enemy. That is the only burden in the region. As if Israel wasn't an aggressor before this war. As if Israel wasn't an aggressor before we strengthen our relation with Iran and before Hezbollah and Iran come to help Syria. Of course they will criticize, because this is against their agenda. The more we get together, the more angry they will feel. Now, I think the reason why the Zionist enemy and Western allies as well are very careful or very anxious about what's happening in the region is the plan to to do a railway between Iran, Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon. This, for them, is a great threat. They say because it carries arms to Hezbollah. It's not because of that. Because it's going to make the region flourishing region, because it's going to do great service to the people of the region. We have to agree that the ultimate aim of all these wars against us is to prevent us from developing, from prospering, from becoming a major player in the region. That is their aim. And therefore, really, we have to learn that whatever they say, you know, we have to interpret it, analyze it, edit it, and refuse most of it.
Well, that concludes our first segment, but brings us with a great push to our second segment of the show to talk about most pressuring issues happening right here inside Syria, where the Syrian civilians are feeling the most of it, which is the economic hardships, because the calamity to the Syrian economy for over 10 years of Takfiri terrorism, Western illegal, unilateral, punitive measures, they cannot be underestimated, and they can be felt by the public. I mean, the heavy combat in Syria is probably over, the heavy bombardment campaigns. But the situation, it's becoming worse by the day economically, especially with the U.S. CSERS Act of 2019, the civilian, so-called Syrian Civilian Protection Act of 2019, and the U.S. looting more than $100 billion of Syrian oil and Syrian resources, where they are occupying land inside of Syria. And there might be some victories still going on the battlefield, and everyone recognizes them, but it's not really tangible to the citizens, but rather the losses are. In your views, how can Syria really survive this painful economic hardship?
Well, before answering this question, let me say something. Yeah. Yesterday, I was attending a lecture by Talal Abu Ghadali at Damascus University, and he said he was on the board of World Trade, International World Trade, and an important paragraph in that is that no country in the world has the right to impose sanction on any other country unilaterally without the approval either of the UN or the World Trade, or without the approval of a body, an international body. And therefore, what the US called Syrian Protection Act, it is actually a criminal act. It's not a protection act. It's a criminal act against the Syrian people. And I see in it a continuation of the terrorist war against Syria, because they failed to make Syria succumb, as you said in your introduction. So they turned now first to occupying the land directly, to robbing our resources. And I don't know how any country can claim to be leading in the world and yet under daylight steals the resources of another people. I mean, this is moral bankruptcy for any country. And so they turned to economic sanctions, to what is called CSERS Act, in order to strangle the Syrian people. Of course, this is accompanied with the media you mentioned, whether pan-Arab media or Israeli media or Western media, against Russia, against Iran, against Syria, against the steadfastness, in order to make the Syrian people give up and say, okay, we can't do anything. But if they read history, they know that this is not the Syrian people who are going to do that. The Syrian people are going to soldier on with finding new ways of survival. Yesterday, our President Bashar al-Assad reopened the center for excellence in Homs. This was first opened in 2009. 2011, the terrorists destroyed it. That was one of the first targets. That proves that they don't want us to be excellent, to be achievers. They want us to be followers of what they want us to do. Syria was able first to make the center carry on in its teaching in Latakia, in Damascus, everywhere, and now to rebuild this center. And yesterday, students went back to the center. farmers went back to their lands. They are sowing, they are reaping, they are producing. This huge problem is an opportunity for Syria to be totally self-reliant in everything it wants. And the Syrian people are so creative and so determined and so rooted that no one will be able to uproot them.
Mm-hmm. Does that simply mean that with Syria